Radio.
In God They Trust, The Faith of Our Leaders. A talk by Roy Williams.
My broad thesis in God They Trust is that personal religious faith has always played a role, a significant role, in Australian politics. But of course, it must always play a role in the background, as it were, because we don't live in a theocracy. We live in a democracy, and we now live in a democracy where Christian believers are a minority, and a shrinking minority. An event occurred on Saturday of great significance, in my view. Whatever your party political views, the election of a Liberal National Party coalition government led by a Catholic was a first in our country's history. And that in itself, when we remember the terrible history of sectarianism from Federation right up until the 1960s, but even beyond the 1960s, a thread that runs through our history, which I'll come to in a moment. With that in mind, Tony Abbott's, he's not Prime Minister yet, I don't think he's been sworn in yet, has he? But when he becomes Prime Minister, he's the first from the Liberal Party. That is a great thing. Let me say a little bit about sectarianism. It's one of the, and I come to you as a Protestant Christian. But in the research of this book, I have to say my admiration for the Catholic Prime Ministers rose very substantially. My admiration for the Protestant Prime Ministers, well, it varied very much from man to man. But one of the underlying issues that I try to tackle in the book is that theme that was always there and which affected the life and career of virtually every Prime Minister, certainly up until the 70s, but even beyond there, and certainly Tony Abbott. I don't think it's possible to understand this historic achievement of Abbott without understanding that history of sectarianism. It began, of course, because the Irish Catholic settlers to Australia, the first wave in the late 19th, early 20th century, were a minority. And a distrusted minority. There were fierce debates in the late 19th century about state aid to religious schools, where a combination of bigoted Protestants and secularists won the argument. No state aid. But of course the Catholic Church fought for decades and decades, ultimately through the DLP, to change that. But sectarianism was worsened during World War I because of the two conscription plebiscites and the actions of, in my view, the worst Prime Minister we've ever had, Billy Hughes, who belonged to every political party bar the Country Party. He once famously was asked at the end of his career, "Oh, Mr. Hughes, note you've been the longest serving member of the House of Representatives. He was there for 50 years unbroken. And he'd served about 10 years in the New South Wales Parliament before that. Belonged to every major political party, but not the Country Party, Mr. Hughes. Why not?" Now, Hughes was famous for his blasphemy, his rasping voice, among many other things. He turned to this person, might have even been Artie Fadden, the then leader of the Country Party. "Ah, brother, you've got to draw the line somewhere." I actually argue in the book that Hughes, despite all his myriad faults and his disgraceful heightening of sectarianism during World War I, was a believer. He wasn't a particularly good Christian, but he was a sincere believer in a creator God and in an afterlife and in divine judgment. So we had the conscription plebiscites, which split the nation straight down the middle, and the yes case, backed by the Protestant churches and the conservative parties, split the Labor Party in two, of course, led to Hughes going over to the conservative side, creation of what was first called the Nationalist Party, then the UAP, then the Liberal Party. The first Labor split in 16, the second Labor split in 1955 during the height of the Cold War, where what became the DLP members of the ALP caucus left under Doc Evatt's leadership, and then the fight by the DLP to win its battle on state aid and also to do its part, as it saw it, and Australia's part, to win the Cold War, to remove communist influence from within the ALP and to help Menzies and the broader West win that Cold War. They're the themes that run through the first 60, 70 years of the 20th century. State aid debate, of course, was resolved finally in the 1960s. We now take it for granted. When I speak to younger audiences, they're actually really surprised that the idea of government funding of private schools was ever in question. You know, that of all parties, the Liberal Party was the party that most vehemently opposed it for many, many years because of the anti-Catholic bias. Now, Sir Robert Menzies played an extremely honourable role in ending that debate. Menzies had a very honourable record as regards sectarianism, dating right back to his youth. He, of course, was a Presbyterian, and a very sincere one, by the way. Another thing that surprised me somewhat in my research is I'd written off Menzies really in my own mind as no more than a sort of cultural Christian, a formal Christian. But the more I read into him, the more I came to the view that he really was steeped in it, and particularly as a young man, as an old man, he took his theology very seriously. And it was he and, on the Labor side, Gough Whitlam, who'd also been raised in a staunch Protestant household. His father, his mother, his sister, his uncle, all very pious Baptists. Menzies on the Liberal coalition side, Whitlam within the Labor Party fighting off. Well, the Labor Party was split three ways, of course. Labor Party was split between the Catholics who desperately wanted state aid. The Catholics, a significant number who didn't want state aid, because they felt the church was better off, all things considered, not having any government interference, even if they remained impoverished. And then, of course, you had the anti-religionists, the secularists, who were gaining ground in the ALP in the 60s and have gained a lot more ground since, opposed to any funding of religious schools, quite apart from the sectarian angle. Now, with all that history in mind, we come back to this fact that Tony Abbott is now the first Catholic Prime Minister from the Liberal Party. Of course, he's not the first Catholic Prime Minister from the conservative side of politics. It was Joe Lyons in the 1930s. But he really is a unique case. He, of course, started out in the Labor Party, very staunch Catholic. Was the Premier of Tasmania, Labor Premier of Tasmania in the 1920s. Senior minister under Jim Scullin's government when the Depression hit, and then he was recruited to go over to the conservative side of politics, create a new political party, the United Australia Party, and unite the anti-Labor forces, which had been a rabble, and had been led by an atheist, by the way, J.G. Latham. So Lyons took over from him and was the friendly Catholic honourable face of conservative politics, and he brought hundreds of thousands of voters, Catholic middle class voters, across to the Conservative Party for the first time. A vitally important demographic development. Now, the Liberal Party then lost them when Lyons died and Menzies and others took over. But they came back in stages through the DLP and then ultimately through Malcolm Fraser. But it was a very slow and tortuous process. So you did have Lyons, demonised forever, of course, by the Labor side as a rat, though Conservatives would say he saw the light. My own thesis in the book is that Lyons really, and this is to his credit, he didn't really belong on either side of politics. Of all our prime ministers, with the possible exception of Scullin, he was the most conscientious Christian of the lot. And for that very reason, he found it hard to relate to either the union-dominated and indeed communist-infiltrated ALP in the 30s, or the big business, big end of town which ran the UAP. He was also a pacifist, or the closest thing we've ever had to a pacifist, Lyons, and throughout the 1930s he supported every attempt by the British government to appease the Nazis and to prevent war in Europe. A fascinating story, Lyons. But I regard him as sort of the exception who proves the rule. Until Tony Abbott, all leaders since Federation on the Conservative side have been either staunchly Protestant or at the very least deeply Protestant in a cultural sense. That's where their votes came from. That's the constituency they identified with. Now, of course, we've had a number of Catholic prime ministers from the Labor Party. I mentioned Jim Scullin. Manning Clark once said of Scullin that for him, Christ and Labor were one. And if you're asking me to nominate who was sort of the best Christian ever to hold the office of prime minister, I would say Scullin. But there's also no questioning he was a failure as a prime minister. And he was very unlucky because he assumed office just a couple of weeks before the Depression. It wasn't his fault. But for a fascinating combination of reasons, he could not meet that challenge. And when Lyons went over to the Conservatives, he lost in a massive landslide in late 1931. But in terms of his Christian principles, and Menzies said, who admired him greatly, Menzies said Scullin's integrity was absolute. But perhaps Scullin's example shows that the best Christian is not necessarily the same thing as the best Christian prime minister. In fact, I'd argue strongly the two are virtually incompatible, especially in this day and age. John Curtin, Michael mentioned in his introduction. Curtin, of course, was born into the Catholic Church. His family were believers, and he briefly considered the priesthood. Curtin, but he abandoned the church as a teenager for a very interesting combination of reasons. But I argue in the book, and I think there's good evidence to support this, that in his twilight years, the war drove him back to God. He never stopped searching for God. He had a number of people around him who were encouraging him in that search. People on both sides of politics and within his own office, and his wife, who was a Presbyterian. And in the end, it's very likely Curtin did make some kind of, not deathbed conversion, but some kind of late conversion to a loosely Protestant form of faith. That's my argument anyway. Not everyone agrees with it, but he's written off as an atheist by many writers and Labour true believers. Chifley, who Michael also mentioned, his mother had actually spent time in a convent. He got his middle name, Benedict, from the convent in which she had been, Sisters of Charity, I think it was. And he was baptised in robes which had been sewn there. He, of course, fell out formally from the church because he married a Presbyterian woman. And then, in all probability, it would seem on the evidence, was unfaithful to her. But he continued to worship. Continued to worship within Catholic churches all of his life. Again, some people question this. Some people argue that Chifley can't be regarded as a sincere Christian because he defied the papal encyclical about marriage to a Protestant in a Protestant church. It was in Glebe. But nevertheless, my argument is that Chifley did remain a believer. And there's very good evidence, apart from anything else, that he read the Bible extremely assiduously. He read it 11 times in his last, from cover to cover in his last couple of years on earth, and exchanged correspondence with a couple of priests about theological issues. It's interesting to me, very interesting, that Tony Abbott has often referred to Chifley with admiration. Abbott once described Chifley as the best DLP Prime Minister Australia's ever had. Which is actually very inaccurate because Chifley deeply distrusted the groupers and didn't get along with them at all. But I know what Abbott was trying to say. He was a very old-fashioned Catholic, working-class, dinky-dye Labor man. And that's the ethos that Abbott grew up with. He was very much leaning towards the Labor Party himself until he turned 30. There's correspondence between Abbott and B.A. Santa Maria from the late 1980s that shows that Abbott, in trying to decide which party he was going to join, his sympathies were really with Labor. And there's some great stuff where he criticises what he called the economic Ramboism of the coalition. And Santa Maria wrote back and said, "Oh yes, they're thoroughly reptilian. Oh, you can't throw in your lot with them for all Labor's faults." Of course, at university, Tony was in the DLP club initially. He did join the Liberal Party, well, he held his nose and did it because he thought it was a more convenient springboard to success in campus politics, which it indeed was. But it's clear that his sympathies, and this is after he came out of the seminary, so he spent the 4 years in the seminary, 84 to 87, and then was mulling for years over which party to join. The story is he was ultimately put off because Paul Keating was too much of a Republican. He was obsessed with the Republican issue. Keating always said that he was a Republican because he was a Catholic. And Abbott, of course, has always had to reconcile his deeply sort of Anglophile ideals with his Catholicism and the fact that a Catholic, of course, can never be royal. And he's written very eloquently about that, actually. It's worth looking up in his book about the monarchy. And then finally, to complete the list of Catholic PMs, we have from the Labor Party, there's Keating. Now, in the book, I don't mind admitting, I nominate Keating as, all things considered, and despite all of his obvious flaws, our finest Prime Minister, since World War II anyway. Certainly our most important Prime Minister, in the sense that Keating's vision for Australia, which I argue is very much rooted in his Catholicism, combined two sort of groundbreaking strains. One was the liberalisation of the economy, but in a way that preserved social justice. So using a sort of, if you like, broadly Protestant work ethic notion to open up the economy, but to ensure that Medicare survived, compulsory employer-funded superannuation came in, the various things that keep our social safety net very strong. And he was a Labor innovator in that sense. The second thing, possibly even more important, was Keating's vision on issues of race. So issues to do with the indigenous population and issues to do with Australia's place in Asia. Now, both of those strains made him deeply unpopular, but he stuck with them, and they're now, of course, both conventional wisdom on both sides of politics, and that's why I argue that he's our most important post-war Prime Minister, with the possible exception of Alfred Deakin, the great founding father, our most important Prime Minister, full stop, because he dismantled Deakin's original Australian settlement, protection, white Australia, and so forth. And I also argue, and again, some people disagree with this, but I believe the evidence is there, although I'm acutely conscious that I didn't get to interview Keating. I asked twice, but he politely declined. As I'm since told, he always does when asked to talk about his faith, because he regards it such a deeply private thing. That said, my argument is he's not a mere tribal Catholic, as most people write him off as, and there's a surprising amount on the public record, both in terms of his statements as Prime Minister, in Parliament and out, and before and after he was in office. So that's sort of a very brief survey of the Catholic Prime Ministers. Let me just skip over, if I may, the batch of Protestant non-Labour Prime Ministers from Federation up to the modern era. Full stories in the book, but you first of all had Edmund Barton, our first Prime Minister, still the only man to have served as both Prime Minister and a Justice of the High Court. Very distinguished man, extremely well educated, a classicist, a nominal Anglican in my estimation, but deeply, deeply Protestant in sensibility. Alfred Deakin came next. Deakin was Barton's Attorney General and very distinguished lawyer, and then the most important early Prime Minister. It was his vision for Australia which became Australia, what Paul Kelly's called the Australian settlement. Now, Deakin was also the most religiously minded Prime Minister we've ever had. He was a theologian. He was steeped in not just Christianity, but every world religion. He wrote hundreds of private prayers. He wrote works of theology. He even wrote works of sort of Christian poetry and fiction. It's all there. It's all survived. And he was really an ecumenicist, probably best described as a deist rather than a Christian. He certainly believed in a creator God, personal God, who took an interest in him and each person. But his intellect and his might have been too broad for his own good, in the sense that he found it difficult to accept that Christianity was the truth. He had particular trouble with the doctrine of the atonement, though many of us do. Anyway, Deakin wrote in fascinating fashion about those things. You then had George Reid, the Free Trade Prime Minister. He was the son of a Scots Presbyterian minister, served down at Scots Church in the city. Very close friend of John Dunmore Lang, the original really fiery Presbyterian founder of New South Wales, and a radical anti-Catholic. Reid was one of his best friends. Joseph Cook, who was the Prime Minister at the outbreak of World War I, a lifelong Methodist, an early founder of the Labour Party, but another Labour rat. He went over to the Conservative parties before Federation, very interestingly, on an issue of religious principle. Cook was a pretty mediocre Prime Minister, but he was absolutely right about one thing. He abhorred the idea of the so-called solidarity pledge within the Labour Party. The rule, which still applies, that all members of the Labour caucus must vote in Parliament in accordance with the majority decision of caucus on pain of expulsion from the party. Now, that was brought in the 1890s for understandable historical reasons, when the early party was fighting all and sundry and trying to get off the ground, and poverty really was utterly dire, and they felt they had to stick together. But Cook saw, as a very religious man, a Methodist, as I said, saw that that would really straitjacket the conscience of Christian Labour members of Parliament to what he saw as an unacceptable degree, and that made him leave the party. And and the Liberal Party, although it likes to call itself the party that doesn't have that rule, in truth has become just as bad. And if there's one reform, I argue this in the book, if there's one reform I would make to Australian politics, it is to both major parties loosen that rule and allow our prime minister, allow our parliamentarians to actually exercise a genuine vote on every issue, except possibly supply issues, financial, you know, the stability of government issues, as happens in the United States. So you get shifting coalitions on different issues, economic, social, military, and so on. I've mentioned Hughes, a real character, Welsh Baptist father and an Anglican mother. As I say, I think he was a believer, but a most irascible and unlikable character, although so horrible he's sort of funny at times. Stanley Melbourne Bruce, who was our most wealthy and most gentlemanly Prime Minister, later became really a world statesman of some eminence and the president of the Royal and Ancient Golf Club at St Andrews. He was an interesting man. Gerard Henderson once called him the embodiment of the Protestant ascendancy in Australia, though I argue he wasn't really an observant Christian in any meaningful sense of the word, but certainly notionally an Anglican. Then we move to the creation of the Liberal Party by Menzies in 1944 to the string of Liberal Party prime ministers before Tony Abbott, all Protestant. Menzies himself, of course, who I've covered, at one stage in his government, although Menzies wasn't a sectarian, there was only one Catholic MHR from the Liberal Party in his entire administration, Sir John Cramer, who actually went on to become a mentor to John Howard, who also had an honourable record on sectarianism. He was one of the early opponents of it, and one of the early supporters of Menzies in the 60s in the state aid debate as the president of the Young Liberals in New South Wales. Howard tells this funny story about being rung up by Bob Askin in the 60s, and Askin, when he heard that Howard was supporting this push for very modest at that time aid to Catholic schools, threatened him with all sorts of dire consequences. And that's what the Liberal Party was like in those days. Harold Holt came next, of course, after the Menzies reign. Nominally Anglican, in fact, I argue in the book, of all our 24 prime ministers, counting Abbott, Holt is the one and only person who I would describe as essentially untouched by religion. Really just your typical apathetic Australian who, you know, rarely turns his or her mind to these questions. He just sailed through life, and he was a very nice man by all accounts. A very nice man. And had a distinguished career. But in terms of religion, he stands out because of his lack of interest in it. And he's the only one. John Gorton, who's actually written off by many as having any kind of religious faith, he was an Anglican. And I argue that, and this surprised me, Gorton was another surprise. Gorton wrote and said some extremely interesting things about Christianity, which I quote. And I actually argue that by the end of his life, I would class him as being a most unorthodox believer, but a believer. Then you had Billy McMahon, another surprise packet. Now, no one would nominate Bill as one of our more distinguished prime ministers, but he, like Kevin Rudd, was born a Catholic. McMahon's father was a Catholic, Rudd's mother was a Catholic. Both of them in their late teens converted themselves by a process of very deep thought and wide reading and, I'm sure, very sincere cogitation and prayer to a broadly Anglican form of faith. And McMahon actually wrote a very interesting paper in the 1950s when he was a young Member of Parliament at the Menzies government about the links between his Christian beliefs and his political beliefs. Essentially, he was trying to make the argument that the Liberal Party was the true home, or should be the true home, of Christians, or certainly Protestant Christians, anyway. So it's an interesting read. Malcolm Fraser came next. Like Bruce, a very wealthy man from Presbyterian background, although his mother was Jewish, a fact that was concealed from him for a long time. He also lived in a family deeply riven by sectarianism. And he's written very eloquently on this to say that his later stand on issues of race and religious tolerance, very much influenced by the fact that he was increasingly nauseated as a child and a young man by the bitterness of the anti-Catholic, anti-Jewish feeling in the circles he moved in. But he himself has to be classed as an agnostic, although he said different things over the years, but in his most recent memoirs he admitted he thought he'd studied too much philosophy at Oxford. He had some atheist lecturers and tutors and never quite got over his intellectual doubts, although, as you've said, Michael, it's never too late for anyone. And finally there was Howard himself, raised a Methodist for his first 30 years, but moved over to the Anglican Church when he got married. I asked him about that. And said, why did you and Jeanette... I interviewed John Howard for the book and Kevin Rudd. I asked John Howard a bit, why the Anglican Church instead of the church of your upbringing? And he sort of smiled and said, well, I suppose in a matter like that I'd defer to my wife. And then I sent him a draft of that quote, and he said, oh, hang on. I had been going to an Anglican, St. James he'd been going to a bit, apparently, before his marriage. So he had dabbled a bit in Anglicanism. His point, and it's a fair one, and Rudd made it too, is that he wanted to worship within the same church as his wife. So when Rudd had been worshipping in the Uniting Church before he married Therese and then he moved into the Anglican Church, and Howard did the same thing. So who have I not mentioned? I've not mentioned, in my opinion, the most devout, well, unquestionably the most devout Protestant Labour Prime Minister. In fact, there's only one, and that's the great Andrew Fisher. Served three terms before and during World War I. A great man. He was a child labourer in the mines in Britain, rose from nothing through the Presbyterian Church, and a faithful Protestant Christian all his life, did very fine things for establishing that social safety net I referred to in the first 15 years of our country, things we now take utterly for granted, things like the old age pension and basic industrial safety provisions, roads, railways, our currency, even the Commonwealth Bank, all legacies of Andrew Fisher, whom Rudd told me is the Prime Minister he most admires. And I read it only this morning that Rudd now wants to... Someone is leaking within the Labour Party yet again. Rudd's told me he wants to be like Andrew Fisher. He wants to be the only other Labour Prime Minister who's served three separate terms. both Queenslanders. And then you round off the list with the agnostics within the ALP, the agnostic prime ministers from the ALP. So Chris Watson, the first, 1904, very interesting man, and actually converted to Catholicism before his second marriage, because he married a young Catholic after his first wife died. But it appears that went nowhere. But he did go through the the course at St. Mary's Cathedral. But his funeral was at St. Andrew's. So I don't know what that says about... Gough Whitlam, I've sort of alluded to, came from an extremely devout family of Baptists. And of all our prime ministers, with the possible exception of Deakin, Gough is the one who knows the most about Christianity. It's a sheer matter of knowledge of its theology and history and architecture and all the rest of it. And I've had very frail now, of course, but in past years I've had conversations with him about it. He knows his stuff, believe you me. We had a conversation for 20 minutes about the extra-biblical sources for the life of Jesus, you know, from Roman historians and so. He knew it back front. Hawke, of course, who was the son of a Congregationalist minister and a practicing Christian, serious practicing Christian until his 20s, lost his faith, so he's explained it, in India while on a student conference, a Christian conference representing Australia. And then Julia Gillard, mischaracterised, in my opinion, as an atheist. I think she's really just an unbeliever. She was actually exposed in her teenage years to a lot of instruction in her local Baptist church in Adelaide, but for various reasons obviously drifted away from that grounding and possibly underplayed her cultural Christianity, in my opinion. It certainly didn't do her any good electorally. So that's the broad picture. That's the legacy that Tony Abbott is coming into. Now, I'm conscious of the time. Perhaps we can do Abbott by way of questions rather than me talking, but my broad thesis, and you know, I could well be proved wrong, is that people who fear Abbott on the basis that he's some mad monk and he's going to bring some kind of theocratic rule to Canberra, I've got nothing whatever to worry about. I don't doubt that he's a sincere believer, theologically, in Jesus Christ as his saviour, but his record to date on a whole raft of issues strongly suggests to me that his loyalty is certainly not to the Vatican, because he has defied its edicts on a whole string of issues, both to the left and to the right. So we haven't got another Sir Thomas More on our hands, even though, like Sir Thomas More... Well, Sir Thomas More never trained for the priesthood, but he apparently seriously considered becoming a monk. And Tony actually tried it for 4 years. You must read his article, if you haven't, from the Bulletin in 1987, Why I Left the Priesthood, if you want to understand anything about Tony Abbott's Catholicism. And like More, he's a lawyer, but he never practiced. He never had the faintest interest in the practice of law, and indeed, I think it's to his credit, he never had the faintest interest in making money. He was a trade unionist and a journalist. He's a very good writer, apart from anything else. He's a very fluent writer. Battle Lines, whatever you think of its content, is a really well-written book. So Tony Abbott is a most atypical Liberal Prime Minister in many ways, and it'll be absolutely fascinating to see how he responds. I noticed in the headlines, it didn't... You only had to wait until Monday morning, the headlines and the business pages. All the big business lobbies, right, pressure now on Abbott to junk all of his moderate promises about economic policy. And he is a moderate. On economic policy. No, we must now get to the serious business of neoliberalisation, even more. But I think he'll withstand that, and certainly hope so. But I'm sure enough of that social justice strain in his Catholicism will at least give him pause on issues like that.
That was Roy Williams with In God They Trust, The Faith of Our Leaders. This talk was organised by the St Thomas More Society and the University of Notre Dame, Australia. For more on the faith of our leaders, Roy Williams' new book entitled In God They Trust is now available for purchase. And for more talks, interviews, and shows, visit cradio.org.au.